South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, it is a real nice morning across South Texas and San Antonio and the Hill Country. Overcast. Looking at possible rain tonight, but what a delightful temperature. It's just going to be a great day to get out. Hope you're planning on spending some time in the garden or maybe taking a hike or just getting out and enjoying nature. Jimmy tells me we pretty much have open lines, so don't wait till later in the show when things get a little backed up and you get busy signals. You know the number, 599-5555 with the 210 area code, of course. So many things to do. I think you're pretty safe now to be putting things in the ground like tomatoes and peppers and eggplant. Would not recommend planting okra quite this early. The soil is still a little too cold for okra. Plant it too early, it kind of gets stunted, and it never really seems to recover, even when we get back to that blistering summer heat. So put that one on the back burner. You can certainly also plant bush beans. My favorite happens to be Tavera for this time of year. Bush beans are one of those things you're going to plant two or three crops of through the summer months. And as we get into hotter weather, I like to switch to contender or top crop or one of the others. It seems to be a little more heat tolerant. But if you want a delicious bush bean that is a heavy, heavy producer early, try Tavera. I think you'd be really well pleased with it. Squash, of course, crook neck, straight neck, patty pan. You can also plant winter squash. We actually plant summer squash and winter squash at the same time of year. Big difference is your so-called summer squashes are producing in 45 to 55 days. Your winter squashes don't really wait till winter, but it'll take them 85 to 115 days to produce. So kind of a misnomer when we talk about summer squash and winter squash. Doesn't really have anything to do with things that withstand cold weather or something. The so-called winter squash, they're definitely not grown in the wintertime. Just that up north, where they have to plant much later, it's usually wintertime before they can start harvesting those long-season varieties. But anyway, both of them do very well here. Golly, so many things to talk about and so many interesting things. Flowers out there. I still think it's a little early for periwinkles. It is true that the newer varieties are much more tolerant, much more resistant to the disease called Phytophthora wilt. That's the one that if you plant too early, just literally thousands and thousands of periwinkles just fold up and die every year from this disease called Phytophthora wilt. The newer varieties, more resistant to it, but my suggestion is still wait till the weather's a little warmer, the soil's a little bit warmer before you plant too much in the way of vinca, periwinkle, whatever name you use for it. Certainly time, though, still a good time to plant petunias. They're just gorgeous, and they're going to continue giving you lots of color all the way up to the really hot weather of summer. If you want things that'll last all summer, I think you'll find the nurseries are starting to get in pentas, which go all season long, starting to get in, oh gosh, some beautiful marigolds. Looking at salvias, looking at celosia. There's just an awful lot of beautiful color out there, both annuals and perennials. Perennials, lots of different varieties of salvia and kufia and all those. So there is absolutely no reason to have a drab landscape out there at this time of the year. There are plenty of beautiful things you can plant. Jimmy, phone line still empty?
We're about to get some. Just a second.
All right. We'll have phone calls to go to momentarily. Other things I would certainly recommend, if you haven't fertilized this spring, by all means, do so. You can use a liquid product like the Hestrolon or something like that, but if you go with a liquid on grass and shrubs and things, you're going to have to redo it about every 30 days. If you go with a good granular product, whether it's from Nature's Creation or Maestro Grow or Medina or whomever, those products will typically last 3 to 4 months. So the granular products aren't available quite as quickly as the liquids are, but on the other hand, you don't have to use them nearly as often. If you've had a yellowing problem in the past, I certainly do recommend adding a little bit of azomite. You can either mix it in with the fertilizer or you can just apply it on the areas where you've had some yellowing problems. Works well on grass along with bedding plants, ground covers, shrubs, anywhere that you have a yellowing problem due to micronutrient deficiencies such as iron and zinc and things like that. Azomite's sure the product that will put all the minerals in the soil in a form the plants can absorb and use very quickly. Golly, I could just go on and on. I saw some examples, some true examples of brown patch fungus. Most of the samples we've been looking at so far have actually been grubworm damage left over that people mistook for brown patch, but saw some true brown patch out there. And of course, that's easily identifiable when you lift up on the St. Augustine blades and they just separate away from the runner, look a little bit brown and mushy down at the bottom. That is brown patch fungus, easily treated and cured with whole ground cornmeal, but again, a lot of people confuse grubworm damage and brown patch, but apparently there still is some brown patch out there. And speaking of grubworms, I've seen quite a few June bugs. Seems to me like it's a little early in the year to be seeing so many June bugs, but when you're seeing that many of them, you know they're out there laying eggs, and that makes for grass problems a little bit later in the summer. It's not the big old grubs you find when you're digging around out there to do the damage. It's a little bitty one. It's a newly hatched one called first and second larval instars. Those are the ones that can really tear up the roots on your grass and bedding plants and vegetable plants as well, but grass is where we see the most damage. And the other interesting thing to keep in mind is that even though the grubs start doing their damage almost immediately after they hatch, sometimes it can be as much as 2 or 3 months before that damage starts to show up, because what they're doing is cutting the roots, and the grass can get along for a while with a root system that has been damaged, compromised. But by the time you see the damage, you know, it's probably spread even further, and it may be quite a while before your grass really recovers. So if you're seeing as many June bugs as I am, plan to get some beneficial nematodes and get them under control before they cause a lot of problems for you. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go ahead and get a break out of the way, and then we will start with phone calls. I get to talk to you for a moment about my friend Dr. Mark Williamson, and that is such a pleasure because he is just a man among men, a dentist among dentists, a guy who really does it the right way and has been doing it the right way for many, many years. And what's the right way? Well, that's treating your patients individually, not looking forward to the next person or thinking about how many people you're going to see in a day. When you're in Dr. Williamson's office, you are the sole focus of his attention. And he is so broadly trained. So many dentists coming out of dental schools these days are taught that basically if it's anything more than just cleaning or filling, send them off to a specialist. Well, Dr. Williamson is that specialist. I can't think of any sort of oral health problem that he can't take care of right there in his office. That's going to save you time, going to save you money. And he does, carries on what he and Dr. Staffel pioneered in different terms or different types of sedation dentistry. I guess that's still the word they use for it. Many different forms, some light, some a little bit deeper, where he can get a lot more done in one visit, and where those of you that have some dental anxiety, you just don't worry about it. I just can't say enough things about Dr. Williamson and his staff, both their competence and their manner. I think if you're looking for a dentist, if you're new to the area, you really need to check out Dr. Williamson and Associates. Conveniently located out on Cherry Ridge Drive, that's just north of 410, just east of I-10. Really easy to find out there, and I believe it's called Conroy Square, if I remember the name right. And if you need more information, give them a call, set up that appointment. 210-341-2569. 210-341-2569 for Dr. Williamson and Associates.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Looks like my first three callers are Mark and Steve and Wade. Mark is first in line. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
It's just a nice day out there. Going to be a beautiful spring day, it looks like.
That's true. I have a front yard that's inundated with weeds. It's been a little neglected well with the drought and all earlier. So I have probably 90% weeds over a Bermuda grass. Uh-huh. What can I do to get it back to just having the Bermuda grass? Should I just kind of redo it since it's so far gone, or what do you suggest?
No. Bermuda grass hadn't even started to grow yet this spring. Bermuda grass is a hot weather grass, and main thing I'd do is just get out and mow. Most of the weeds you're seeing right now are things that are going to die out as soon as the weather warms up a bit. I would mow, I would fertilize if it's in the budget and in your time frame. Get some compost. About a quarter to half an inch of compost will do a great deal to suppress future weeds. It'll soften the soil. It's one of the best things out there to encourage grass to grow and spread. So, like I say, I would just mow. Don't waste your time on weed killers, because all the weeds, the dandelions, the henbit, all these things are going to give up when the hot weather hits anyway. So just mow them off and fertilize. Those are the two critical things. And like I say, if you can, a layer of compost over it, and by midsummer, you'll have the prettiest yard on the block.
Okay. And then also, I have a garden with some pepper plants. I've noticed that there are little holes in the leaves. Randomly, about the size of a pinhead. What
probably, probably a beetle of some sort. You know, it's early. Peppers are one plant, especially the hot peppers. I don't usually plant them for a week or two after the tomatoes are in, but lots of folks getting an early start. It is almost certainly, if there are small, relatively round holes, it's probably a little beetle. If they're more irregular, kind of like a side chewed off or something like that, it's more likely caterpillars. But those little round holes you get are usually a little black beetle, and you can control them easily and safely with something like spinosad soap. Straight spinosad will do it, but you can buy the spinosad soap pre-mixed now, and you can get it as concentrate. You can get it in ready to spray or ready to use, all three forms, and totally safe for people and pets. The active ingredient spinosad is safe enough that we actually give it to dogs as in an oral form for flea control, so I don't hesitate to use it in my garden. And it knocks out pretty much all of the chewing insects.
Okay. All right. Sounds great. And I just do have one comment. I called you a few weeks ago. I had a live oak tree that was a majestic live oak tree that was looking pretty sick. I put out the azomite and the growing green, and right now with all the spring coming out, I mean, it looks great. I don't know if
good.
It was just coincidental or if it worked, but it's bright green right now.
Well, you gave it what it needed. I have to say it probably would have come out anyway, but it's coming out a little bit better because of the effort you put into it. So I think you did the right thing, and I'm glad to hear it.
All right. Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you, Bob.
A pleasure, Mark. Thank you, sir. Next in line is Steve. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
A question about the bluebonnets. Over the last couple of years, my wife and I have seeded a number of different areas on our property out here in Spring Branch. Mm-hmm. And this year, they finally really just burst out of them. It's thick. And all
I tell you.
Colors and
the weather has been right for wildflowers this year. I say wildflowers, the bluebonnets are always among the earliest, but I don't ever remember a year seeing them any prettier than they are now. And just everywhere, people's yards, along the roadsides, and totally unexpected places. And I wish I could figure out what it was about the weather this year. I suspect that it's the fact that you know, once the seed germinated, we got those little rosettes of leaves. We had some rains, not necessarily soaking rains, but enough rains early in the season so that rosette developed well. And then when it warmed up a little bit, the result was just spectacular color. And because we've had follow-up rains, they're holding up very well. I'm with you. It's just a gorgeous thing. And who knows? Next year, they could be very scarce, but this year we can really take pride in our state flower.
Yeah, we're pretty happy about it. What we want to do is collect some seeds and populate some new areas. So that's my question is about, you know, once the seed pods start forming and looking brown, I'm kind of wondering what are my signs for actually collecting those and then waiting to put those out this fall.
Well, don't really wait till the seed pods are brown, because by the time they're brown, they're getting real close to opening. You just look at them wrong and they'll pop open, and it's real hard to pick the seed up off the ground. When the seed pod starts to yellow, that's an indication that the seed is mature. At that point, I would harvest the little spikes, probably let them get a little drier just to make it easier to separate the seed from the chaff, as they say, but if you can wait until they get brown and then just you know, kind of have one hand underneath it while you pick the other, because, like I say, they do pop open and can sometimes fling the seed some distance. But you should be able to do well. Talking to John Thomas, man that owns Wild Seed Farms, one time, we were asking him about amounts, and he said that they figure that a good field of bluebonnets will produce 1,200 pounds of seed per acre, and said even with the best equipment out there, they're only able to harvest about 400 pounds per acre. But if you're careful, you can probably, you may have a sore back, but you'll get as much seed as you want to spread next year.
Great. So just when they start to yellow, and then I should, maybe if I put them in like a big envelope or something.
I hope you're going to have more than that. I hope you're going to have a paper sack's worth.
Yeah, like a big manila envelope or something like that. Yeah, and put them in there when they're yellow, not brown, and then just kind of wait for them. Then can I just leave them that way until I'm ready to use them in the fall?
I like to take the seed out of the pods. Just makes it a little bit easier, a little bit cleaner. And I would, rather than putting them in an envelope initially, I would put them in some sort of open container to let the seed pod finish drying. And then as you separate your seed out into the envelope, keep them in a cool spot. Doesn't have to be the refrigerator. And since you're dealing with fresh seed, there's no need to worry about scarifying the seed. We scarify bluebonnet seed that's been in storage for some time, but you're going to have wonderfully fresh seed, and you're going to be planting it 3 or 4 months after you harvest it. So you should get plenty of seed without having to scarify, and then it's just going to depend on the weather next year, how the spring crop is again.
Sure. Well, that's perhaps why it took them a few years to get really started, because we bought big bags of them from Douglas King, and we didn't scarify or anything. We just threw them out there, so it must have taken a couple years for them to kind of,
yeah, for that seed
get
pod,
to the point where they were ready to germinate or something. Yeah,
where that seed coat was abraded enough to absorb the moisture, which is what allows them to sprout. And that's Mother Nature's protection, because, you know, think about the years when we get multiple year droughts and things like that. That seed has to be able to survive some pretty extreme environmental conditions, and it does it by forming that very hard seed coat, which is not real convenient when you're trying to get them to sprout and grow. But from this point moving forward, if the weather continues to cooperate, you should have, you know, just good crops for years to come.
Well, for anybody else who's planting them from seeds from one of those companies, patience is a virtue, because it really paid off this year, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I've always said about gardening is it does teach you patience. If you're impatient, you need to find another hobby, and it's not going to be fishing or gardening. I can tell you those two things.
Yeah, right. All right, well, I'll let you get on to your other callers. Thanks, Bob. Have a great weekend.
You do the same, Steve. Thank you.
Bye.
Let's talk to Wade. Good morning, Wade.
Morning.
Morning, sir.
First, I want to say thanks for, you know, all the information you provide. I've been listening to you for over a decade now. And
well, I appreciate
and,
that.
Learned a ton. My
Good.
Kids know your voice well. I wanted you to go over again kind of your process for saving seeds. We have a pretty big garden this year, and I wanted to be able to kind of preserve some of my seeds to just use next year. And I know you've talked about it before, kind of keeping them in the fridge and stuff. And I wanted to see if you could review that with me again.
Sure. And specifically, are we talking tomatoes or peppers or squash or okra or all of the above? Okay. Tomatoes are going to come fairly true, especially if you're planting the older varieties, because tomatoes are for the most part self-pollinated, because they're pollinated by the wind, not by insects. So saving seed on tomatoes is simply a matter of, you know, letting the tomatoes ripen thoroughly and then just slicing them open. I like to kind of scrape the seeds into a little colander or something like that. And then washing them. What you're trying to do is wash all that jelly off. It's not that it's harmful, but it's that it'll make a solid mass. It's very hard to separate and plant the seed next time. So just put them in that little strainer, that little colander, whatever. Wash the jelly off. Let the seed dry. Oh, I'd say probably overnight. I like to use parchment, which is, you know, or butcher paper, some people call it. Just spread the seed out thinly on that, let it dry overnight, and then put it in, not in plastic, but in just a paper envelope or something. put it in a jar and put the lid on and seal that jar up in the refrigerator. Our modern refrigerators are being frost-free. They are very, very low humidity, which will tend to dehydrate your seed, and that's why we put all the seeds we're going to talk about, you know, just into, I just use a quart jar and just screw the top on it. Sometimes I've got more seed in my refrigerator than I do food, but pretty easy on tomatoes. Peppers, it's pretty much the same thing. There is a membrane called the omentum when you slice the pepper open. And again, let the pepper become fully ripe, and then you'll slice it open. And I just take a knife, like a paring knife or something like that, and just scrape along the edge of these membranes inside. The seed will fall out fairly easily. And once again, let it dry overnight, and then just put it into an envelope. Be sure to label the envelope with the date as well as what you're saving. Peppers, you can't be sure that they're going to come true, so to speak, because there are a lot of newer varieties of peppers. And being insect pollinated more than wind pollinated, you're going to get a loss of cross-pollination. And when you have that, they may or may not come true to what the parent plant was. Kind of fun, you know, you may end up with what was a mild bell pepper. They artificially, you know, in a garden, they cross the jalapenos and the bell peppers, and then after several generations of saving the seed, they came up with a hot bell pepper. So with things that are pollinated by insects, and this is going to be your peppers, your squash, your cucumbers, things like that, you really can't be sure that they're going to come true. So if you say, well, gosh, I want to save seed for my shishitos, plant them in a far corner of the garden where there aren't any peppers anywhere close to them, and you'll have a much higher percentage of the seed will come true to what the, you know, what the parent plant was. But again, the process is just simple. Scrape it out of the interior of the pepper. Let the pepper, peppers, all types of peppers will pretty much turn red, even ones we normally eat when they're green. When they're fully mature, when that seed is mature, the pepper's going to take on a reddish cast, and that's when you know that you're at a position that you can go ahead and harvest the seed. Squash and cucumbers and melons, basically let the fruit get large, let it begin to, the stem where the fruit is attached to the vine will tend to shrivel and crack a little bit. That's usually a sign that the fruit is fully mature. It's going to be so tough you won't be able to eat it. But at that point, once again, slice it open. In this case, probably use a spoon to go through and just kind of scrape the seed out. Once again, I would wash them. I would let them dry and save them in the same manner. And that's going to be the same for cantaloupes, for squash, for cucumbers, for honeydew melons, for watermelons, that whole family, we call that group of plants the cucurbits. Easily, seed is easy to save. But once again, because they are insect pollinated, mainly by bees of one sort or another, they may not come totally true to what the parent was, but that's just a chance you take. You may get a plant that was not quite as good as the parents. You might get a plant that's about like the parents, or you might get a plant that's better than the parents were. So that's the fun of hybridizing, but that's how you would save those seeds. Okra, you would simply leave the pods on the plant until the seeds rattle. When you can go shake that pod and you hear the seed rattling around inside, you'll know it's fully mature and dry, and then it's just a matter of breaking the pod open and saving the seed in the same fashion. Oh, what have I not covered? I guess beans would be another thing. If you want to save seed from bush beans or lima beans or black-eyed peas, which are really a bean, once again, let the seed pods go ahead and begin to yellow, begin to dry a little bit. At that point, you can harvest them. You just kind of pull that little stringy thing along the edge of the seed pod, pop the seeds out. Again, put them on parchment to dry and save them in the same fashion as the other. And that's pretty much all your summertime vegetables. Maybe another time, if you want, we can talk about carrots and radishes and beets and things like that. But I think that pretty much covers what you'll be growing this summer. Yeah. That tell you what you need to know?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I have one other thing to talk about real quick.
Yeah.
If you have time.
Certainly.
It's just I live in the sand, and I know I've been talked to you before, and I've listened to lots and lots and lots of other callers call about the cut ants. And so I've been observing these things and battling these things for at least 8 years now on the property that I have. We have about 10 acres in the sand, and we had a big area of cut ants that was here before we were here, and who knows how long. And they were it was massive mounds, and so our garden was only about 40 yards from there, and quickly learned how destructive they are, and mm-hmm. So went through every single technique that you have described and then I've read about on the internet, from the organic side of things, from flooding them to using the wettable sulfur to everything else, and nothing gets them every time. The flooding right. worked decent, but this is what I've learned is that you really have to go and kind of patrol for them on almost every day basis during the spring to be able to control them effectively, because in
You're
the
right.
sand they are everywhere.
Oh yeah,
everywhere. And that we have some land in the black and in clay soil, and you can find their mound and get rid of them pretty easily. But in the sand, it is much different. And so I've used the foggers and pretty effectively, and that's been kind of the quickest, most effective method that I've found that really gets them because mm-hmm. they will destroy your garden in the
oh,
night.
Oh yeah, overnight. Yep.
But one of the things I wanted to share was with that I had some young trees that I used the tanglefoot on for a while.
Uh-huh.
And when they have that, when their bark is still young, in the summer, that tanglefoot would drip down and really damage the bottom of the base of the tree.
Yep.
Where some
yep.
of them, it took a little while for them to recover. So what I figured, what I tried was several ways to kind of get it a little bit more away from the trunk.
Uh-huh.
So I used some of the things that Dr. Kirby talks about, that you put around the neck of the animal, and
yeah,
they make
the collars,
birds, and everything else.
Oh yeah,
yes, sir. And
yeah.
So I take a noodle from the pool and cut a little piece mm-hmm. and put that around the tree, and then put the collar upside down on that where
that makes
the larger
sense.
Portion is facing downward, and then put the tanglefoot on the outside of that, and it wouldn't be able to drip down on the trunk of the tree. It's a little bit more labor intensive, but that didn't let it drip as much, and then they have a little bit more work to do too to get around the trunk, to get up there. So that's worked for me pretty well.
Well, thank you for sharing. If you don't have the pool noodles, the other thing you can do, especially this time of year or during the winter months, go out and buy that foam stuff that you can put around pipes to reduce the chance mm-hmm. of the pipe freezing, and you don't have to cut up your toys that way. But that's a great solution to the problem. Really appreciate you sharing that with everybody, and I'm sure a lot of other folks out there do as well, because cut ants, unless you're somewhere way up north, they are a problem, especially when you get over places like East Texas where you've got the timber industry and the paper industry. They've spent millions of dollars trying to figure out how to control them. They still don't have a good plan, so I don't worry too much that you and I aren't on top of it immediately, but it sounds like what you're doing is working, and once again, really appreciate you sharing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wade. I know we'll talk again. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, let's pause for a moment and talk about azomite. You hear me talking about azomite all the time, and it's because I recommend it, I use it, and it works. Three simple reasons. Azomite is a natural mineral product. It's an ore that's mined. You remember it's Arizona or Nevada, somewhere out there, those ancient volcanoes somehow managed to put a lot of different materials in a relatively small package, so to speak. Azomite has more of the things that will keep your plants green and healthy than any other product I know of. The iron, the zinc, the manganese, molybdenum, cobalt, sulfur, iodine, all those things that the plants need relatively small amounts of, you find in azomite. It's a natural substance, has nothing to do with being man-made. We crush it to different degrees depending on how you want to apply it, but it is a totally natural product, and it never burns, and it never goes bad. Probably has a shelf life of about 10,000 years, I would guess. And that should be long enough for most of us. So if you want to get things off to a great start when you're getting your vegetable garden ready or your flower beds ready, work in some azomite. If you've got yellowing plants in the landscape, whether it's grass or whether it's your bedding plants like vinca that can tend to really have yellowing issues over the summer months, stock up on azomite. It's not that expensive. You can get a powdered, finely powdered form. You can put it in water. You have to keep shaking it to keep it in suspension, but you can spray it out if you like. Or you can do what I usually do, get it in the granular form and just kind of put it out by the handful. You'll find azomite wherever fine gardening products are sold. Once again, natural product, no toxicity to it, and it really does work. Azomite, azomite.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. If you're getting a busy signal a minute ago, got some lines open now. You know the number, 210-599-5555. Next in line is Cindy. Good morning, Cindy.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I have a question about the rock phosphate that you talk
okay.
about for tomatoes.
Right.
I've been putting it in the holes when I've been planting tomatoes for the last 2 or 3 years. And then I was wondering, is it beneficial to do that with other vegetables or even flowers?
Great question. It is definitely beneficial, but on tomatoes is where we see the most dramatic results. On tomatoes, actually weighing the fruit, we found that you will double the number of pounds of tomatoes you get. It helps with peppers. It helps with eggplant, but I don't think anybody's really quantified it. It's certainly not going to be quite that dramatic, but it will certainly get you more fruit, and the fruit tends to be a little bigger. In some cases, a little bit meatier. So definitely beneficial, but I think it's essential on tomatoes and a good idea on other things. Flowers, it probably increases the blooming a bit, but I don't think you're going to see as dramatic a result with, you know, periwinkles and petunias and all the things that we tend to plant. But it's certainly a good product to use, but just no matter what you're using it on, it's necessary to do as you've done on your tomatoes, to put down an effective layer of it, let the plant put its roots down through it, because if it gets blended into the soil, it's almost immediately tied up by the alkalinity of our soils in a form that the plants can't get to. Sadly, I have to, you know, tell the story on my departed friend Malcolm Beck. Malcolm Beck tried it, found out what a huge difference it made in his tomatoes, and went out and ordered, I don't know, 1 or 2 tons of it, and spread it around and plowed it into his huge vegetable garden and got no results whatsoever. And then discovered from that experience that when it's blended with the soil, doesn't really benefit your plants. It needs to be, in effect, in a solid, thin layer that the plants can just grow their roots right through, and that's how they get whatever magic it is in there.
Okay. And then what about the Epsom salts? How do you apply that?
Epsom salts can be applied a couple of different ways. I just take and sprinkle a couple of handfuls just on the ground around the tomato plants. You can do that with other things as well, but tomatoes are the principal plants that get this condition called blossom end rot, where the bottom portion of the tomato just turns dark and shrivels up, and it doesn't really ruin the whole fruit. You can just slice the bottom off of it and the top will still be good, but it's not a disease or anything like that. It's when the calcium and magnesium in the soil get out of balance. And so, like I say, I just scatter a couple of handfuls around. It dissolves as we get rain or watering. If you want to get a little faster results, go ahead and dissolve it in water. The rate is about 2 tablespoons per gallon of water. Dissolve it, and then just pour that over the root system of the plants. I do it dry just because I never have enough time to do everything that needs to be done, and it just takes a little extra time to dissolve it and pour it on. But either way will give you the same results.
Okay. Great. And then I have a quick question about composting, if you have time.
Certainly.
I have noticed over the years that I put a lot of things in the compost pile, but the eggshells, I crunch them up really good before I put them in there, but they just don't seem to decompose very quickly. And I still put them out in the garden, but I'm wondering, am I doing damage by doing that?
You're not doing any damage, but you're not really accomplishing anything other than keeping the eggshells out of the landfill. I don't think there are enough eggshells out there to seriously threaten, you know, the space in our landfills. But once again, because of the alkalinity of our soil, the eggshells just don't break down. And the good side is that we've got all the calcium we need in our soil. So eggshells are sort of superfluous. I mean, I guess that's Mother Nature's way of recycling. And it doesn't hurt anything to, you know, have eggshell in your soil.
Okay.
But you're not really benefiting anything. But I guess the Solid Waste Division of the city of San Antonio would give you a small round of applause for one more thing that you didn't put out in the garbage can. You're not saving the world, however. You're just saving a little space. But again, that's the problem with so many of these guides and things are written in a different part of the country, where eggshells do wonderful things in the garden, but not in our part of the world.
Okay. And so then the related question to the composting is, if I see things that aren't quite decomposed, but I'm ready to put it out in the garden, is it okay to go ahead and just put all of it out in the garden?
Are we talking about vegetable matter, or are we talking about... Okay. Yeah, go ahead and put it out. It's close enough. The soft things that you're throwing away, we call them RVs, for rotten vegetables that didn't get eaten one way or another, they're far enough decomposed that they're not going to deplete the soil in any way. We do not work in, you know, oak leaves or twigs or things like that, because when you leave things up on the surface, the microbes that break it down can actually take the things they need from the air, nitrogen in particular. They have a way of absorbing it from the air and using it. When you bury things into the soil, they obviously aren't exposed to quite as much air, so they end up taking what they need from the fertilizer rather than letting your plants use it. It takes a lot of nitrogen and some other things to decompose woody materials. So if you're going to blend it in, you better be using a lot more fertilizer. But in general, your softer products that break down quickly, you're not harming a thing.
Okay. All right. Great to know. Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Great questions. I appreciate your call. You get out and have a wonderful day. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you. You too.
Certainly.
Bye.
Goodbye. All right, I guess we better get a break in here. Megan and Pam and Chicken Joe are my next three callers. Looks like I get to talk to you about Rhonda's Nature's Way. Now, Sunday's the one day of the week that you don't get to go see Rhonda's because they are closed every Sunday and major holidays. But the other days of the week, I just love going to Rhonda's. There's just so many things. I frequently, if I'm in a hurry, I just call my order into her and run in and pick them up and go. But when I have time to stay and walk through and really look at all the things she has on the shelves, I'm just continually impressed at all the good materials she has. Her supplements, her vitamins, her different things, like I take an immune support formula, take a heart support formula. They're just various things that you really need that we may not be getting in our diets. And Rhonda has the best of the best, far better than anything you're going to find at the grocery store or a chain pharmacy. And special problems, whether it's sleep issues or mood issues or digestive issues, yes, she has answers for those. I recently had to call her because just doing a lot of real heavy physical work and get some leg cramps at night. She gave me a boron product that totally solved the problem, and once again, great for the body. Rhonda also does reflexology. If you've never had a reflexology session, it is just amazing how it will make you feel. That lady is just magic with what she can do. Also red light therapy, beamer light therapy, foot bath detox. They do lots of other good things. And if you're trying to lose some weight, she will let you lose the weight and still enjoy the process while you're enjoying some other things that are very flavorful, even quite sweet, but don't have all those sugars and carbohydrates you're trying to avoid. And let me encourage you this summer, be sure when you're out working, sweating a lot, be sure you're getting the electrolytes you need. And I highly recommend the product called Ultima. Just mix with your water in that little bottle. Tastes great. Gives you all the electrolytes you need without adding those sugars that'll put the pounds on. Lots of reasons to see Rhonda's Nature's Way out in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. Just remember Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and let's get right straight back to those phone lines. Let's see, nothing's changed, so that means Megan is next in line. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning, how are you?
Off to a good start. Nice morning out there.
Yeah. I have an old hay ring that I'm not using anymore, and I thought that some vines would look nice on that.
Yeah.
But it's not awful to try to water it. So is there, I'm probably asking for, you know, something that isn't there, but I love a fragrant vine like honeysuckle. Mm-hmm. But I need something that's somewhat drought tolerant, you know, where I don't have to water it all the time once it's established.
Sure.
But I don't know, are there other options out there besides that?
Well, the so-called Confederate jasmine or star jasmine, at least as fragrant as honeysuckle, and blooms probably over a longer season, and actually a prettier vine as well. I would tend to say plant the vines if you can. Plant them on the inside of the hay ring rather than the outside, just to protect them. I mean, you got a natural little barrier there to protect them from armadillos that might want to dig up around them, and skunks and things that might actually want to eat on them. The other thing I would tell you is plant early in the year before it gets too hot, because if you wait until it's real hot, the metal in that hay ring is going to heat up to the point it could actually plant the vines. If you plant the vines first, then the foliage is going to, shield that from the sun's heat. It should not be a problem at all. But for fragrance, I would say another good option is Confederate jasmine. For just beauty, a plant called Tangerine Beauty Crossvine is an evergreen vine that grows extremely easy and is very, very drought tolerant. Another option, there is a deciduous vine, something that freezes to the ground every winter but comes back out, and that is a passion vine. The one that I love is one called Incense, I-N-C-E-N-S-E, and that variety gets that name because it is quite aromatic. I won't say it's a sweet, sweet fragrance like the jasmine or the honeysuckle, but it's very pleasing. Thing, and it will be the most unusual flower probably that you have ever seen. And very hardy, freezes down, comes back out each year. Other vines. There's a beautiful vine that is called butterfly vine or Mascagnia. Beautiful yellow flowers and then very unusual seed pods that really look like green butterflies. Those folks who like doing crafts many times love to collect those seeds and paint them and do all sorts of things that require more talent than I have. Again, not highly fragrant, but it does have some fragrance and, is a most attractive vine. I guess one other thing that I might mention, the honeysuckle that you're probably thinking of is the Japanese honeysuckle, which can be a bit invasive. There is also a native honeysuckle, which is called coral honeysuckle. And beautiful, moderate amount of fragrance, not nearly as invasive, and it's actually much more drought tolerant than the Japanese honeysuckle or Hall's honeysuckle is.
Okay.
Give me some time. I'll come up with some others, but that ought to be a good list to start.
So are all of these, do all of these bloom through the summer? Or do some bloom longer than others?
The ones that are going to be a little more seasonal, the Confederate or Star Jasmine, it has a very strong bloom in the spring, typically March and April. You're about to see them in bloom everywhere, but they don't bloom as much through the summer months. Same thing is true of some of your honeysuckles. Tangerine Beauty Crossvine blooms heavily in the spring and then sort of scatters some flowers over the rest of the summer, but it definitely is more heavily in bloom. The butterfly vine is in bloom all the time. Passion vine, once it grows out from its winter dormancy, it pretty much blooms all the time. And by the way, the passion vine will tolerate a little bit of shade if this area is at all shady.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening, and once again, I apologize for not watching the clock closely enough, Megan, but I think that covers most of what I would tell you about vines. So one other thing that I did want to get in was if you are worried about the heat issue in the summer months, you could always paint that old hay ring. I'd use, one of the Rust-Oleum products or something like that that will stick to metal, but you could paint it a little more subdued color, and it wouldn't become nearly as hot to the touch. Like I say, if you plant your vines early, shouldn't be that much of a problem because the foliage will help shade that metal. But we've all gone out and laid a hand on, you know, galvanized metal on a July day and pulled it back rather quickly because of how hot it was. So that give you some help?
Yes, and so when you say plant early, have I missed the deadline, or can I?
No. No, planting early means before it just gets super hot out there.
Okay.
You've got, I'd say, until early June to get that planting done and give the plants a little chance to grow and get that foliage up there.
Okay.
I
have a lime. A key lime tree that's in a big pot, and it just seems to never produce very many limes, and it was loaded with flowers, so I'm going to wait and see. You know, I added something to the soil to help, but because my kumquats get pollinated easily, I have no problem, so it appears to be something else. What do I need to do to get the blooms to, you know, turn into limes?
Well, to some degree, you may need to improve the pollination simply by getting out there with a little paintbrush or something and dusting around inside of the flowers. Now, you mentioned this was a lime tree in a great big pot. Virtually every plant I can think of really prefers to be root bound. And when you plant a small plant in a large pot, even though it may bloom, a lot of times it doesn't set as much fruit because they simply don't process the water and other things as well. So, and something like a key lime, you're probably going to have to keep it in a pot. But don't ever rush to put a small tree in a whiskey barrel size planter. You're much better to move the pot size up gradually. This year, of course, your lime probably has a better root system than it did last year. But just remember, when you're putting any productive plant into a pot, keep it on the small side. This type of plant is not harmed by being root bound. And the great majority of plants, other than shade trees and things, they are much happier in a root bound state than they are in having a pot that's too large. So hopefully you'll get more, but I think it had a little bit to do with the size of the tree and the size of the pot last year.
Okay, because it's been in that pot. This will be its third season, so maybe it has caught up. And so if I have to choose, I just hate those black plastic pots. I just bought some kumquats and some tissues, and I thought I'm going to, transfer them into pots that are not black because the sun, right?
Sure.
But I think I may have put them now maybe in too big of a pot. I didn't put them in a giant pot, but...
Yeah.
But isn't it better to get them out of those black pots?
There are other things you can do. I mean, you can paint those pots with some kind of paint that will stick to that rubbery material. You can wrap them in burlap or something like that. You can actually buy, nowadays we have what are called fabric pots, and they last several years that are a fabric material that doesn't get hot and allows a lot more oxygen in the soil. I've grown things like sweet potatoes in the fabric pots for a different reason, because they don't spread out all over the garden and then I'm digging up half an acre trying to find the sweet potatoes. You know, I know exactly where they're going to be because that fabric pot contains them. They come in various sizes and shapes, and they're quite lightweight. Of course, when you put soil in, you're going to make them heavier. But beyond that, there are fiberglass pots, which don't conduct nearly as much heat. There's something called fiber mesh concrete that is a very rigid pot, but it doesn't have the weight that a, you know, solid ceramic or masonry pot has. There are several other options, including the old-fashioned whiskey barrels, as opposed to going with metal.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. That answers my question.
Well, you have good questions, and it's good to talk to you. Get out and have a great Sunday.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Megan. Bye. Pam is next in line. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Bob. I love your show. You've made going organic easy. I was worried it wasn't going to be, but it's not very hard at all. So
I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
Yeah. I have a lime tree, too, but mine's a Persian lime, mm-hmm. and I think it's in the right size pot. It has little tiny fruits coming out, but one uh-huh. stem has, the leaves are curling, and they have little brown spots on the back.
The curling is largely due to wind and changing humidities. It's probably not anything bad. I mean, no citrus tree is going to win a beauty contest, and I have to say it's fairly common to see some curling of the leaves, especially early in the season and late in the season. I think you'll probably find that the curling limb with the curling leaves is going to be probably the most exposed one. But I'll tell you not to worry about it. It's not really a sign of a problem. And
it
I suspect
doesn't
that
sound like leaf miners or anything like that.
No, if you had leaf miners, it looked like a road map with little white trails back and forth through the leaves.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So, well, this branch does stick out into the weather more than the rest of the plant.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, Persian limes are great, but they produce like a lemon or a grapefruit. They bloom at one time, and they pretty much ripen all their fruit at one time. If you love limes for margaritas or whatever good reason you have for growing limes, the little so-called Mexican lime or key lime, they are like your kumquats. They can bloom any time of the year, and they can produce fruit at any time of the year. So you get a big crop at one time on your Persian lime, but if you want to have that fruit spread out over a longer season, get one a little, either Mexican lime or key lime, two names for the same tree. Those might be a good addition to your citrus collection.
Well, good to know. I'm not going to worry about doing anything to this branch that looks pretty squirrely right now.
Just cut it a little slack, because not everybody can be beautiful.
Oh, that's
other than you and me, of course.
Right, of course. Well, thank you. I feel good about that. All right. Thanks a bunch.
You're welcome, Pam. Thanks for the call this morning. And that brings up Chicken Joe next. Good morning, Joe.
Hey, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Over the years, I've had a lot of successes and a few failures in starting seeds and seedling trays.
Uh-huh.
So yesterday, I think I met my match. I decided to start some petunias.
Uh-huh.
So I sat down to put the seeds in this little 70-cell seedling tray.
Mm-hmm.
And I was using my, what I call a cedar. It's just one of these little things that's got a round chamber.
Yeah, and then a little, like, prong sticking out that the seed goes through. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I poured this packet of petunia mix seeds into the cedar, and at that point I discovered they made ground pepper look like giant stones. So I had a packet. I think it said it had a minimum of 80 seeds or 800. I don't know, but anyway, I started putting the seeds in the cells, but apparently I couldn't actually see the little seeds when they came out. Uh-huh. And about the time I got to the second row, which would be the 20th cell, I discovered, dadgum, I've almost spent all those 80 or 800 seeds, whichever it was, in those 10 cells.
Yeah.
So I need a little tip. How in the world do you distribute these microscopic petunia seeds, like a couple of seeds per cell? So let me stop talking and listen.
There's no easy way to do it. You can, and I don't, petunias are just hard to grow from seed. That's why, I tend to buy them as established plants. So I don't know. I know in some of the vegetables, like carrots, Some of the seed companies do what they call pelletized seeds, where they coat the individual seeds with the material that breaks down once it's in the soil, but it makes them, you know, the size of small buckshot instead of being, like you say, almost microscopic. The other thing you can look for, and you're taking me way back to the days that I worked with Alton Grimm up in Bernie, but we used to get some of these things as what they call seed tape, which was little tape, you know, maybe a quarter, three-eighths of an inch wide, where the seed was embedded in the tape, and you simply put that tape down, and when it's watered, the tape dissolves, and the little seeds are spread out. But other than that, it's tough. I don't think there's really any way that you're actually going to be effective in counting out the seed. I would probably just pinch some seed between thumb and forefinger and just kind of move along over one row at a time, back and forth and back and forth, and you're probably going to end up with some cells with no seeds and some cells with three or four seeds. But if there's an easier way to do it, I haven't found it.
Okay, well, it only makes me feel very slightly better.
I mean, you can always do something like take some, you know, screen wire or something like that and put that over the tray and just kind of sprinkle your seed over that, and just a small percentage of the seeds will go through the screen and wind up, you know, in the tray. But maybe we've got listeners smarter than I am that will have a better suggestion on planting very fine non-pelletized seed, but you're dealing with a problem a lot of people have faced, and I don't know that anyone has really solved it well.
Okay, well, I'll report to you my success and failure on my next. I got two other factors for seeds.
Well, I will tell you that a lot of people, considering that most seed is fairly inexpensive, they don't worry about getting it seeded a little heavily, and they just sit there with a pair of tweezers and just pluck out the extra little seedlings that come up. Now, some of the newer varieties, some of the really fancier, expensive seed, you probably don't want to do that. But most petunia seed is not that expensive, and like I say, that's the reason that most people buy small petunia plants rather than trying to seed their own.
Right, right. Okay. Well, I had one other question. You know, since 2021, my landscape has been other than beautiful. Snowmageddon. Snowmageddon and the drought.
And COVID.
I'm looking at the four surviving loquats in my backyard. I once had a beautiful privacy screen of loquats, and now I have four stragglers. All of the loquats that I planted to replace them, since I'm not here in the hottest part of the summer, you know, I can't take really, you know, drastic measures to protect them from the 107 degree heat, et cetera.
Right.
And
right.
None of them have survived. And I've heard you talk recently about cherry laurels. And would the 20 years to wait for them to get the height, would that be a good candidate?
Yeah, it's cherry laurel. If you're in a part of town that has good deep soil, it's a good choice. If you're in a part of town with shallow soils, you'll be very disappointed in cherry laurel. You're in a tough situation. And with the loquats, remember, they were probably good for 50 years before we had this winter that was cold enough to harm them. So, you know, I don't have a crystal ball that works. So who knows? It may be 50 years before they get frozen again, or it may be next year. So there are things that you can plant that are more cold tolerant. A bunch of the different hollies, Nellie Stevens, Foster's, Burford's, Standard Burford's, even Yopons are totally cold hardy, but they're slow growing, and consequently to get a big one, they're pretty expensive. The other option is, you know, if you have a fence or if you plan to put a fence up, you can cover it with very fast growing vines that, and some of them like Tangerine Beauty Crossvine are totally cold hardy. Others like Confederate Jasmine, ours froze down in 2021, but it came back beautifully. We had minor damage to it last year, but it's come back out beautifully. So Vines are just almost an instant screen. They don't give you the fullness or the same appearance as a large shrub, but the privacy side of things, you get more privacy in 6 months with a good vine than you will in 6 years with a shrub. So it's just kind of figuring out what works, you know, for your wonderful lifestyle, where you get to spend the winters where it's warm and the summers where it's cool. So I'm not going to cut you too much slack. I'm envious of your ability to do that. I wouldn't mind spending the winters or the summers in Wyoming and the winters here, but that's not an option in my life right now. So you got a pretty good thing going, but the fact that you know, the weather, it takes a toll on you. It's just part of life in South Texas, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, well, listening to you is kind of gendering another question. You know, with the one major Arctic blast that we got this winter, I covered everything with insulate, and you know, my vines, I mulched around them. You know, my once beautiful 6 foot Durantas are now 3 feet tall because every year an Arctic blast takes them to the ground. And with the summer and my inability to pay for thousands of gallons of water to keep them watered in the summer, so they never get over about 4 feet tall.
Sure.
And my question, to get to the specific question, I realize the Arctic blasts are what kill the plants, but do you think, which is the bigger influence, the severe drought with the 107-degree heat, which, by the way, ain't going to go away, or the Arctic blasts, which is the biggest threat?
Both. You know, the cold was more damaging. Cold is always more damaging than plants that are dry. So a dry summer by itself, things can survive pretty well. A cold winter by itself, many things survive very well. But when you, like this year, have severe cold on top of a severe drought, things froze and froze worse than they have at other times. So, like you were talking about mulching, that's always going to help. There are, you know, some drip systems that you can put on a timer. Not that they are, you know, totally foolproof, but they're things that you can do to, you know, help. This product I've been talking about, the Terralock, that you can blend into the soil, reduces the frequency of watering. It has to be blended in, though. You can't just put it on top. There are different clever things that you can do to make your life a little bit easier, but I have to tongue-in-cheek say, just, you know, you're paying a little bit for the wonderful lifestyle that you've chosen to live this way. So you can't have it all, Joe. If it were that easy, well, everybody would do it.
That's right.
I understand. And I'm happy for you.
Well, you brought up another question real quick. You're talking about drip systems. I've got Rainbird drip tube pretty much in all my beds and routed to my trees. I put that, my drip system that's there, I put it in place in 2016. Mm-hmm. And the question that I've been thinking about lately is, how long does that Netafim technology actually last? I mean, is it still pretty much putting out 0.9 gallon per hole, or what?
My observation on this is that the tubing lasts a long, long time. How long? I don't know. I've had some at 5 or 6 years. The little couplings tend to get brittle in the sun. So, a year or two, they get pretty brittle. So if you can cover them up with mulch or soil, the other thing that I think is very important is to put some little clean outs along the deal. And that's just a matter of putting a little pigtail on there that sticks out, folding it over and putting one of those little figure eight things so it shuts it off effectively. But considering the quality of our water in San Antonio and the amount of particulate material in that water, I recommend everyone once a month go around, turn the system on and open those things up and look at all the crud that it blows out of the line. So it's the lifespan of the material is it kind of dependent on the care that you give the material, so to speak. But I don't know. I suspect it'll last 10 to 20 years, but it hadn't been around that long, so we'll see. But blowing it out periodically and protecting the joints, it's going to last a long time for you.
Okay. Well, I figured that was the case, but I thought I'd check with the expert. Okay, listen, I've overstayed my welcome here, so we're going to let you get on to the next caller.
That sounds great, Joe. I appreciate it, and you have a good weekend. Right now, I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and that's always such a pleasure. Southwest Metal Roofing Systems is simply the best roof in the industry, in my opinion. I'm listening to commercials about extending the life of your shingle roof and this, that, and the other. Why not just put on a roof that you don't have to worry about extending its life or repairing it? The Galvalume material that they use is going to last a long, long time. It's the last roof you'll ever put on your home. And Southwest Metal Roofing Systems does new construction as well as roof replacement. If you're building a new home, put on the only roof you'll ever have to worry about on that home. Don't like the look of bright standing seam? Well, they've got lots of different colors, and they've got roof styles that are not like standing seam metal. Look totally different, but still give you that same lifetime quality. And all of them are going to give you the reduced energy bills because they're so energy efficient, and they're going to, most insurance companies are happy to give you a discount on your homeowner's insurance because they know they're never going to have to pay to repair them. There's just an awful lot of reasons to choose Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, as we have done for lots of years. Learn more, give them a call, 210-822-6868, 822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Once again, got a few open lines. I know we had all four of them full there for a couple of minutes, but dial right now. You probably get through 210-599-5555. Next in line is Lisa. Good morning, Lisa.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. A friend asked me a question I didn't know how to answer because I've never cultivated tulips.
Uh-huh.
And somebody gave her a real pretty pot of tulips blooming and in the early February or something. They're faded now and they're still blooming. And uh-huh. I think she was going to throw them out, and I said, don't do that. Put them in the ground. And she said, how do I prepare them? I said, I don't know.
Well, if she really wants to have good luck with those tulips, first thing she needs to do is move about 1,000 miles north. Tulips are beautiful here one season, but we don't usually have enough cold during the season during the winter months to put them into proper dormancy. Now, planting bulbs, you can plant bulbs, and they've already stored up all the nutrient they need to bloom one time, and they've already gone through the appropriate dormant period. So people that love tulips, you know, just plant fresh bulbs every year. I know the Dallas Botanical Garden, somebody up there I think is crazy, but they've planted like 100,000 tulip bulbs, and then sometimes they don't last but a few days when we get really hot weather. So what I would suggest to your friend is put them out in a spot that gets good bright sunlight, water very thoroughly, feed very regularly. Now while they have the foliage on them, this is when the bulbs are rebuilding themselves. And then if we have a cold winter next year, she'll probably have some nice tulips next spring. If we have a really warm winter, well, nothing lost, but they're not going to be nearly as spectacular. Tulips are, oh, they're just like a lot of plants that do well in northern parts of other parts of the country, like lilacs and rhododendrons and things that our soils and climate just really aren't right. So if she wants to, I mean, very little energy expended, go ahead and put them in a area of the landscape where she can water and feed with some regularity. Do that especially now, you know, while they have foliage on them and they're rebuilding the bulbs. And don't follow the planting instructions that you get with most tulip bulbs. Most tulip bulbs will come with instructions that say to plant them 10 inches deep. Well, you do that if you live in Minnesota, but in Texas you don't do that. Tell her just to plant with the soil level the same as it was in the top of that pot. But No promises. She may get a beautiful show again next year or maybe not, but she's got the plants. She might as well plant them and enjoy them.
Okay. Now,
I mean, if they were that easy to grow, everybody in town would have tulips in their yard because they are so beautiful. Yep.
They were beautiful when they were blooming.
Yep.
You were speaking about vines, and it made me think of something I had looked several times for, and I didn't know I don't know the name, but it's a vine that has like sort of clusters of pink little flowers.
And that's another very good vine. It's commonly called Queen's Crown or Rose of Montana. Botanically, it's called Antigonon leptopus. And that's one I just I could go on all day talking about vines, but you're right. I should have mentioned Queen's Crown because it is a wonderful vine that freezes down in the winter and comes back out. The newer varieties just bloom almost constantly through the summer months. And there's a pinkish one. There's a real dark pink one and a white one. But, yeah, the coral vine or Queen's Crown is another great one.
When is the best time to look for them? Because I've never seen them in the nurseries.
I was looking at them at our growers last week. I think they will be available starting probably around the 1st of May. And I don't know why the growers don't produce most of them. Most of the time they start offering them late April, early May. All the growers I know sell out of them fairly quickly. They're hard for a commercial grower to grow because they grow so quickly, they tangle up so badly. It's a mess trying to keep them, you know, to their individual pots and stakes. So while they grow like a weed, it's hard to grow them and deliver them to the nursery. So a lot of growers just don't want to mess with it. But you will find them, and they are excellent plants. But don't let them just sit around while you're waiting to plant them, or they'll try to take over the world around them, and then you end up breaking them, trying to get them taken apart again. So get them and replant them immediately. But typically late April, early May, on into June, that's when you're most likely to find the Queen's Crown.
And that's what I asked for, Queen's Crown.
Yeah, just ask for Queen's Crown. Like I say, I can tell you the botanical name, but you wouldn't remember it, and the people you're buying it from probably wouldn't know it. But Queen's Crown's a good name. There
no,
you go.
Okay. That's all. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You are certainly welcome, Lisa. Appreciate the call. Let me get another quick break in here. I get to talk about Medina Agriculture, and that's always fun because I know the people so well and have known them for many years, and they just do it right. They make products that work with nature. Not all their products are certified organic because that's a very expensive process, but things like their Growing Green fertilizer, yes, that already has a USDA seal on it. Their products are natural products, all of them, and they work to support the life in the soil, to build organic material in the soil, not to deplete it the way synthetic products do. Medina makes great things that for fertilizers. They have dry fertilizers as well as liquid fertilizers like Has to Grow and the Liquid Fish Blend. They have products like the Soil Activator and the Medina Plus that work to soften the soil and increase microbial life. And then they have products from Humates to Liquid Fish to so many different quality things. And Medina's getting out and doing programs around. They did one yesterday at the Botanical Garden. Coming up this Friday, they're going to be out at the Rainbow Gardens location on Bandera Road talking about how to get the very most from your garden. It's just a great company with great products. Take a look at all the products at MedinaAg.com or see them at your favorite nursery and garden center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and to the phone lines. Carol, Kate, Jack, and Penny, my next four callers, and Carol is first in line. Good morning, Carol.
Morning, how are you doing?
It's a beautiful morning out there. Going to be a great day.
Certainly is. As a kid growing up in Edna, Texas, there was a neighbor next door to us that had a plum tree that had lots of small little reddish plums on it. And I really don't think those people did much to care for it, but it was always covered with plums. And
yeah.
So I don't know what kind that would be or if, you know, they're still available anywhere.
They call them just a wild Mexican plum. You'd have to look around. You could call Fanix. They probably have more plums than anyone else, but they're typically sold more as an ornamental tree. We actually get them occasionally, and I think it's probably, like I say, some of the other varieties are so much more productive and have so much bigger plums, but the Mexican plum, it's just a beautiful tree. White flowers in the spring, the little fruit is somewhere between the size of a ping pong ball and a golf ball. Very tasty. 10,000 raccoons can't be wrong. I've seen them come in and strip every single fruit overnight between the coons and the possums, but it makes good jelly, makes good wine, and is not a very big meal, but individually they taste real good. So call around and just ask about Mexican plum or wild Mexican plum, and you may very well find them. I don't think we have any right now. We did last year. We'll be looking through the summer months, but they're out there, but it's not really a specific named variety.
Okay. And then I have a question. In the neighborhood I'm at now in Victoria, Texas, people chop up, like chop huge limbs off of oak trees. And I've been told, well, it's because the grass can grow better if it gets light. I mean, and they chop them up. They're bare until they get to almost the roof of the house. And they don't look like an oak tree anymore to me. And I understand if it's into a power line or hanging over the street or coming into your house. But why do they do that?
You know, one of my favorite sayings has become, you hear a lot these days about AI or artificial intelligence. My line is artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity. And I think that's just a really dumb thing they do. And there's really, I don't know of any benefit. It's true that if you get more light, your grass will grow a little better. I'd rather have a beautiful oak tree with ground cover underneath it than grass. And, you know, like you say, if the limbs are rubbing on the roof or if they're up in a power line or something like that, sure, you just, 100 years ago, somebody planted the tree in the wrong place, not anticipating, what's grown up around it. But I know of no benefit that provides the tree. And there's some people that just do it because people say that's what ought to be done, and they don't really question the reasoning behind it. So I've been about as nice as I can be. I don't think it's a very good practice, obviously.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Because, of course, they come by my house and say, oh, your oak tree looks like it needs to be trimmed up. And I'm like, no, I hate that. So anyway, then the next thing I'd like to ask is, because these trees are older, the house is probably 29 years old, and so I'm assuming it got planted somewhere near that time. And the root flare is totally covered up. And I mean, at one point someone put the metal edging and there's some ginger and some other plantings in there. Mm-hmm. So is it best to just go ahead and leave it after all this time, or should the root flare be covered up?
No, it will benefit it if you do uncover the root flare. You don't necessarily have to, just broaden it out 6 or 8 feet wide or whatever. All you have to do is expose it enough that there's air circulating around the portion of the top of the root flare and the trunk. Everything that would normally be exposed to air needs to stay exposed to air. So it's probably not like my friends with an air spade had a pecan tree up the street from us. They had to go down 6 feet to find the root flare.
Wow.
And then just build kind of a chimney around it. I don't think you will find that they're buried that deeply, but the trees long term will very definitely benefit from having that soil pulled back, even just a short distance away. You just want to get air circulating around the trunk.
Okay, great. And then one other thing, of course, because of the oak trees, we have lots of leaves that fell. And when they get in the flat, I get them mulched with by the mower people in the yard and just don't bag it. But in the flower beds, is it okay to leave them as a mulch, or should they be raked out?
No, they're fine like that. You know, Mother Nature's been doing it for a few hundred thousand years, and things are still growing. So Again, you might spray them down with some molasses, some Medina Plus, or things like that to help speed up the decomposition. But they're building the soil. They're not a bad thing in any way.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much. I certainly enjoy your show.
I appreciate you calling. Say hi to the folks over at Earthworks for me there in Victoria.
I sure will. All right.
thank you so much. Bye-bye. Goodbye. All right, Jimmy, let's get our last break out of the way. I don't have a live here. We'll be back momentarily, and it'll be Kate and Jack and Penny.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to the phone calls. It's going to be Kate and Jack and Penny. Kate is first in line. Good morning, Kate.
Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a mountain laurel tree that gets attacked by bagworms each year.
Uh-huh.
And I've been using BT to kind of combat that. And I wanted to be a little more proactive this year. And I wondered if there's a regular BT spraying schedule I could use so that they don't appear at all.
Well, you can, there's several things you can do. Spraying with BT, if you put a little molasses, about a tablespoon per gallon of spray, that will make your BT stay on the tree a lot longer. And, again, it's just a stomach poison to the caterpillars, and it will generally keep them from ever getting started. If you want to hang out the little strip of Trichogramma wasp larvae, which is what we put out for the little caterpillars that get on the oak trees and the ones that burrow down into the pecans and things like that, hanging a strip or two of the Trichogramma wasps will do it. It's this tiny little stinging wasp. You'd never even see them, probably. And finally, the caterpillars that get off the mountain laurels usually only go after trees that are somewhat stressed. So check the base of the tree. Be sure the root flare is exposed. Probably put a little fertilizer out. Watch your watering very carefully. Typically, something there is putting the tree under stress, and that's what the caterpillars are attracted to. So I know it means getting down on your hands and knees and looking very carefully, but I suspect you're going to find that your mountain laurel was buried too deeply. It may even have some of the twine they use to tie up the root ball when they first planted. It's still on there that could be cut. But those caterpillars you see all the time on trees in town, and you rarely see them. I've got probably hundreds, if not thousands, of mountain laurels growing on my ranch, and I don't know that I've ever seen a caterpillar on them. But they haven't.
Yeah.
They're not planted or planted too deep or whatever. So try to relieve any stress, but I would certainly suggest spraying some of the BT with a little molasses in it, and that's probably going to keep them from ever getting started.
Okay, great. Okay. My second question is, I bought an Arctic Frost at Puma.
Uh-huh.
And can I plant it in the ground?
Arctic Frost is...
I'm in Hays County, so yep. It says cold hardy to 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
I would say it's cold hardy to maybe 18 degrees. Yes, it's going to make a moderately large tree, so it's much better in the ground than it is trying to grow it in a pot. And just figure if we get an extraordinarily cold winter, wrap the trunk for sure, wrap the top as best you can. If you've wrapped the trunk well, even if the top should freeze, the tree will come back out and it will still be an Arctic Frost. But I'd highly recommend putting it in the ground. That's one of the trees that just gets too big unless you've got a pot that's 6 feet in diameter, which has its own share of problems with it. But no, plant your Arctic Frost this afternoon.
What kind of sun can it take? Can it be like intense, full sun all day?
The more sun, the more fruit. There's no such thing as too much sun or too much heat.
Okay, I have a spot where my fig tree does really well, so, okay.
Your satsuma should do very well there.
Great. Okay, thank you so much, Bob.
You are certainly welcome, Kate. Appreciate the call.
Have a great day.
You too. Mm-hmm. All right, let's get Jack in here before the news break. Good morning, Jack.
Hey, Bob, thanks for picking my call. What I'm calling about is I had a tree company come out and trim one of my larger trees, and I had a smaller tree planted about 10 feet, maybe 15 feet away from it. But when one of the limbs was cut off, I wasn't there. I didn't see it happen. But anyway, it fell down and it broke off. I didn't break them off, but split about six limbs on that smaller red oak. Mm-hmm. So I went on YouTube and it said, you know, stick them back up there and it'll probably be okay. So we got some duct tape, put them back, duct taped them back on, and then put some cord to hold them in place.
Uh-huh.
So my question is, was I supposed to mix up some kind of batch of, you know, like the dirt doctor says, make some kind of, you know, cooking, you know, like some kind of special formula stuff to stick it in those?
What they call tree goop. I hate to tell you, you probably would have been better off just to cut those limbs off. It's like splinting a bone together. It will eventually heal, but it never gets quite as strong as it was before. I would have greatly reduced the amount of money I paid those tree trimmers and just, you know, deducted the damage they did to your other tree, because there's no excuse for that. A good company at the very least would have just set up a stepladder or something over, you know, your new tree to keep the limbs from falling on it, but that's just strictly negligence on their part. Now, it is important on any wound, and if you cut any branches off, that you go ahead and paint and seal those wounds, because red oaks are very susceptible to oak wilt. But in general, you know, where any trunk has been damaged or anything like that, what Howard Garrett calls a tree trunk goop is something you just kind of slather over the trunk just to protect it from sunburn or further damage. But when a limb is truly split and broken, red oaks are very fast growing trees, and I really can't tell you without seeing the tree, but I would have probably recommend just cutting those limbs off. The tree should grow plenty of new limbs pretty quickly. Good man that you could talk to is a fellow named David Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-A-N. He doesn't have anything to sell you but a little bit of his time, and he's the best arborist I know. If you'll look him up under Vaughn Arbor Care and give him a call, you can probably just text him a picture of those trees, and he'll tell you what should or shouldn't be done, and he might not even charge you for it. He's a heck of a nice guy. But I would call David. I would send him a picture and say, hey, how do I best deal with this? And I would trust him. He's the guy I trust and call when I have tree questions.
Okay, great. Well, I'll call him. And one last quick question. I'm going to put in a windmill palm in my backyard, and I need to know how.
Yeah, it's a great, great tree, Jack. But let me put you back on hold and talk a little more after the news. This is KTSA Radio in San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Sunday morning out there. Jack, we were talking about you were getting ready to plant a windmill palm, so I have to get out right on the second for those newscasts. But tell me about the windmill palm.
Well, the one I'm putting in is about a foot and a half tall, so I know that they grow fast. I just need to know, how far from the house in the backyard do I need to plant it?
Well, the roots are not going to be any problem at all. Don't worry about your foundation. Windmill is not a huge spreading type of palm. That top is probably never going to be more than 5 or 6 feet wide. So, gosh, if you stay, you know, 6, 8 feet away from the house, you'll be have no problems with it whatsoever. It's palms have a different type of root system than vascular trees do, or woody trees do, I guess I should say. So 6 or 8 feet is all you need to stay out, and you're not going to hurt your home by planting it closer. It's just that it, you know, could get up there to where the fronds would rub on the soffit or the limbs. You've made a good choice. The windmill palms are probably the most cold hardy of the upright palms you can plant. They just have very, very few problems. So if you like palm trees, that's one of the best palms you could possibly plant. I take it you've got a tree that is in a container. You're just going to take it out of the container and put it in the ground?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Because a lot of them are sold bare root, and we have to do bare root planting. We have to do that in the hotter months of the year. But where you get one in a container, you can do it 12 months out of the year. And it's one of those things I would try to plant it at about the same depth it is in the soil right now in the pot, but it's one of those unusual plants that has a totally different structure to its trunk, and we really aren't concerned about root flares and things like that on a palm tree. So planting is going to be easy. It's going to be the most cold-hardy palm you can plant. You're going to have a lot of years of enjoyment from that windmill palm.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your help, and I'll call Mr. Vaughn.
David's a good guy and very knowledgeable. I mean, if you want to pay him to come out and look at it, he can do that too. But in this situation, you know, Dr. Kirby's always talking about, well, just take a videotape of what your dog's doing, and it's a lot easier. In this case, a picture's probably all you'll need to send him to get the help you need with what to do with that.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too, Jack. Thank you, sir. Thanks. Penny is next in line. Good morning, Penny.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Oh, it's a beautiful day, and I woke up, so thank you, Jesus.
Amen. Amen.
Yes. So, a couple of questions. I remember not too long ago you were talking about a plant and that you should plant in your garden for, like, if you get stung by an insect something or bit by something. Was that comfrey?
Yes, comfrey.
What was that called?
Yeah, comfrey is what it's called.
Okay, so I got that, and thank you. Now I need to just go find one, excuse me. And with the mountain laurel seeds, you said to, do I take them out of that little pod thing before I sand them down to plant
them? Yeah, take them out of the brown seed pod, and then just scratch them. You really don't have to sand them down. You just have to kind of abrade that waxy coat on there so that the seed can absorb moisture, which is what it needs to sprout. So, just take them out of the brown pod they're rattling around in. Just scratch them lightly with a fingernail file or sandpaper or triangular file, whatever you have. Soak them in Garrett juice for an hour or two and plant them. The majority of them will sprout within a few weeks.
And does the part that I scratch need to be facing up, or does it matter?
It doesn't matter. It makes no difference whatsoever. All the scratching is done is make it possible for the seed to absorb the moisture, and that's what it needs to sprout. A seed it literally knows which way is up and down. You plant it any way you like, but this little process called geotrophism will tell it which way the roots need to grow and which way the top needs to grow. You don't need to do anything more than just get it into the ground. Don't plant them too deeply. Probably about an inch deep is as deep as you would ever need to plant a mountain laurel seed.
Okay, and one more thing. I had planted some bleeding hearts and some gladiolas back towards the end of January. February, and they're growing nice and tall. About how much longer before I should be able to see blooms?
Well, with the gladiolus, you'll probably see blooms in about 30 days. I'm glad they didn't get frozen. Gladiolus are a warm weather. They're actually a corm rather than a bulb, and we normally don't plant them until March or April, so you're lucky they haven't frozen. Now, bleeding heart is a common name for two or three different plants. Is what you planted a bulb or a shrubby little plant or a vine?
I planted the bulb, and it's growing kind of bushy and real soft pretty right now.
Okay. Probably it'll be about a month before you see flowers. Just needs to warm up a little bit more.
Okay. And I think that's all. If I need something else, I'll call back next week. So you have a wonderful day, and thank you.
You do the same. I'll tell you, we're going to be off on Easter. I will be doing a Saturday show as usual, but they're going to give the staff at the radio station a day off for Easter Sunday. So everybody get out and go to church as the Christians of the world should on this most important day. So you have a wonderful week in the meantime, and I'll look forward to our next visit.
Yes, sir. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Penny. Bye. All right, Jimmy, let's get a break done here. We'll be right back with more gardening.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's really an interesting day out there. Looks like not going to be much sunshine, but very pleasant temperature and possibility of another good rain tonight. Keep your fingers crossed. The next three callers are Omar, Scott, and Clint. We start with Omar. Good morning, sir.
How you doing, Bob?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, the same old, same old. It's a little cool today. I guess I'm not. I don't think I'm going to be putting my started vegetables out today. I think I'm going to leave them on the mat and give them some light.
Well, that certainly won't hurt anything. It's I think we're safe on most things, but I worry more at this point about, you know, too much wind and that blasted stuff called hail that we seem to have had a bit of recently. But you're probably right. Probably tomorrow will be a good day to plant them as well.
Yeah, it's supposed to be windy today, and they're not but about 3 inches tall right now. So.
Oh yeah, no, they're not ready. They're not ready for the big wide world.
Yeah, dirt mud daubers or dirt daubers? What I got? They love the inside of a garage door. And I mean, it's unreal how quickly they can set up shop. But is there a beneficial bug that can be released or what can be done to keep them from doing what they do?
Not a lot. I hate to say it. What they're doing is they're building that little mud chamber and packing it full of paralyzed spiders and then laying an egg on top of it. They're a remarkably well-adapted plant and or creature, and I have to tell you, I spent part of my high school career in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where so much of the nuclear stuff was done, and they started finding radioactive mud around the city. So just having them on your garage door is not as bad as it could be. They don't like... they don't like the color blue, just like wasps don't, and it's no guarantee. But I tell you, when I planted the underside of my balcony, that light, what they call haint blue color, I got almost no dirt daubers, and I got almost no wasps. Now, why that is, I can't tell you, and I can't say it was 100% on the dirt daubers, but they're pretty efficient. They find, you know, on my 100-year-old house, they find a way to get through the tiniest little hole in a screen door and build inside on the door itself if it's not a door I open all the time. So I wish I had a better suggestion to you, but other than, you know, that light blue paint color, which they don't seem to care for, I really don't know how we can really repel them. I would love to say make the surface rougher, but they love to build on the rough brick. I'd say make it smoother, but they seem to be able to attach that mud. On a real smooth metal, they don't do as well. But I'm sorry, I don't have a surefire answer for that question.
Gotcha. All right, well, I'll play around with it. If I've ever figured out, I'll let you know.
I will look forward to hearing from you, and you get out and have a great Sunday.
All right, you too. Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much, Omar. Next in line is Scott. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Wanted to ask you about honeysuckle. I've got about a 30-foot run down the side of my house. Is the common honeysuckle a good choice?
It can be invasive. It tries to take over. It grows out, grows over shrubs and things you don't want it growing over. It's not my favorite choice. There's nothing wrong with it. It is fragrant. It is relatively drought tolerant. But just be sure you like it, because once you plant it, you're probably always going to have it, no matter how hard you try to get rid of it. I'm not fond of it because it wants to grow out over all the other shrubs and just like I say, just in effect take over an area. But if it's part of your yard where that won't be a problem, go for it. There's a Japanese honeysuckle, and then there's one that's kind of a yellow and white flower called Hall's, H-A-L-L-S, Hall's honeysuckle. And they're both vigorous, you know, hardy growers. Now, I happen to like the native honeysuckle, which is a totally different one they call a coral honeysuckle, because it's not quite as invasive, but If you like honeysuckle, plant it. Like I say, there's not a problem with its health or its adaptability here. It's just that sometimes it does too well.
Is it the most fragrant, the common?
It probably, yes, it is probably the most fragrant. Again, honeysuckle is not even in the same league as some of the jasmines, star jasmine or Confederate jasmine, and some of those are much, much more fragrant. But on the other hand, the honeysuckle does tend to bloom over a longer period during the summer months.
All right, sir. And the height of it, I'm trying to cover the side of my house, the slab, and it's probably like 10 feet high.
Well, it...
Will it go that high?
Oh, yeah, it will certainly grow that high. It doesn't have any way to attach itself. It's not like English ivy or fig ivy, these things that actually make a little structure that attaches it to the side of the house. You will have to give it a trellis or, at the very least, put some nails in and just string some fishing line back and forth or something like that, because it has to have something to grow over and wrap around to support itself. But, you know, it would go probably 30 feet up the side of a home if you let it.
Wow. What kind of spacing should I use on going down the side of my house?
Kind of depends on how much of a hurry you're in. If you want it covered tomorrow, plant the little plants about a foot apart. If you were willing to give it a growing season to really fill in, you can put the plants about 5 feet apart. And obviously, the closer you plant them together, the more quickly they're going to cover. They don't really crowd each other, so there's no problem in planting them close. It's just a little bit harder on the pocketbook.
All right, sir. And one last question for you. I use the vinegar and orange oil to get rid of the Bermuda where I need to plant these. But the grass is coming right back within 4 or 5 days. Is there a way to keep it from doing that?
Bermuda is just the toughest thing. It takes multiple applications, and Bermuda is hard to keep under control, and I don't really like weed block fabrics because they just destroy the soil so much. You might plant your honeysuckle and then put several layers of newspaper or cardboard or something like that will suppress it, but it's going to be an ongoing battle to get rid of Bermuda grass. It just grows too well.
Will mulch keep it from coming back?
No, it'll grow right through the mulch. In fact, I had a bunch of compost dumped in my vegetable garden one time, and this mulch pile was about 3 feet high, and within a month the Bermuda had come up through it. Mulch will make it much easier to pull out because it won't be able to anchor itself in the soil the way it does, you know, in our bare ground. But mulch will make it a lot easier to pull out, but nothing short of nuclear weapons is really gonna kill it out. If we had talked last summer and you said you were going to plant it in the spring, I would have told you to solarize the area, cover it up with plastic in the hot part of the summer, and just let it roast underneath that. It's like, you know, leaving something in a hot car. It just literally burns it out. And that's what we do in vegetable garden areas and things like that, where you want to actually kill it as thoroughly as possible. But unfortunately, solarizing doesn't work until we get into the July, August kind of weather. And I'm sure you want to plant your honeysuckle before that. So it's going to be a bit of a challenge. And, you know, if you get your exercise, you can cancel your gym membership because you're going to get plenty of exercise pulling it out.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right, sir. Well, thank you very much.
All right. You're sure welcome, Scott. Appreciate the call. Thank you, sir. Let's see here. Let's take one more call before we take our mid-hour break, and that would be Clint. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself? Did you get a good rain the other day?
No. It was just a little sprinkle here and there, not much.
That was me, but some folks around got an inch or two, so at least it's out there. Maybe tonight we'll get luckier.
I tell you what, that bigger rain I had a couple weeks ago along with that Medina is making that coastal look really good.
And good and healthy and full of nutrition. The good fertilizer and all just does a whole lot more than make it look pretty. Your animals that you're feeding it to will be healthier as a result of it, too.
Yep. Now, I had a question regarding the vinegar orange oil. Remember you said put a big squirt of dish soap to help it stick to the plant, but didn't you also right. say to put molasses in with it?
For whatever reason, molasses seems to make it more effective. I don't really have an explanation for that, but I tried it. Howard Garrett's tried it. A number of his listeners have, and they say it just seems to increase the killing effect of it, but I don't have an explanation for why. I just know that it works, so I do it. And one of these days, we'll figure out what the mechanism of it is.
How much molasses per gallon?
Probably a tablespoon.
A tablespoon?
Yeah. And that old agricultural molasses, same thing you're spraying, you know, to improve the growth of your coastal will improve the killing capacity of the vinegar and orange oil.
So what does molasses not help out with?
Your waistline. it's really a, you know, it's one of those things that you can do too much of a good thing. If you overuse it, you can overstimulate the microbes. I mean, if you're putting it into compost tea, you have to be very careful not to put too much or your tea will go anaerobic on you because it kicks the microbial reproduction into such a high level. But, it's not the molasses that's magic. It's just the food source for the beneficial bacteria in particular. It doesn't do as much for the beneficial fungi. For those, we use some different things, but it's got, if you're using the agricultural molasses, it's got a little bit of urea in it, which is a good fertilizer. It's just across the board, it just supports the life of the soil, and that naturally is going to give you better plant growth.
Remember you saying you can add it to BT and a couple other things? It's kind of amazing how versatile it is.
Oh, it is. And, of course, what is BT? BT is Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a beneficial bacteria, and it's just kicking that into high gear because of its nitrogen content, urea content when you get the agricultural stuff. It's also in a cation form that binds to the soil, so it's not going to wash away those nitrate, like the nitrate fertilizers do. So quality material. I won't even mention the fact that they make pretty good rum out of it down in Jamaica, but that's a whole other story.
Oh, most definitely. Okay, that's all I really had today, so I sure appreciate your time.
Oh, it's always good to hear from you, Clint. Get out and enjoy this Sunday, and keep your fingers crossed for a good rain tonight.
Take care.
You too. Jimmy, let's get our half-hour break done and then come back with some more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. My next two callers are David and Janie. A couple of open lines, and we're down to the last 30 minutes of the show or so. So if you've got a question, probably be a good time to dial 210-599-5555. We'll be doing the Saturday show next week, my 5:30 till 9 in the morning garden show. But Sunday, we're going to take Easter Sunday off, the whole station is. So unfortunately, won't be here for those questions next Sunday. So get them in today if you can, or we'll hold them for the following Sunday, whatever. Back to the phone line. Next in line is David, then it'll be Janie. Good morning, David. David, are you there? Okay. David, are you there?
I put that one back on hold.
Okay, I bet Janie's ready. Good morning, Janie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. You know, the sun ain't out, but it makes me work more outside because the sun is not out.
It's a great day. It's when a little heavy exercise actually feels pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, I got a question about the mountain laurel. Am I saying it right?
Yes,
well,
you
I
are.
I told that to my husband, and they come up with some grape that's called mountain laurel.
No. Properly, you could say Sephora secundifolia, which is its botanical name, but mountain laurel is a lot easier.
Okay. You were talking to somebody about how to do that from the seeds. Well,
right.
I was very fortunate. I got some of those seeds, and I put them in pots. And I didn't do anything what you said, but I was lucky enough to have one growing And it, I guess it was like 1 year, maybe less. And this year, it got flowers. I couldn't believe it. You know, not flowers, but the one that looks like grapes, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You're a good gardener, Janie. You did it right, and you obviously had some pretty fresh seed to be able to get it to germinate that quickly. It's even tougher than bluebonnets as far as being able to sit out there for years before it sprouts. But you had fresh seed, and you treated it properly, and now you've got a new mount laurel.
So I picked one that was just probably fall, and I just put it in a pot then, huh?
Yeah.
I'll be darned. Okay. Okay, and I'm going to go to Phoenix to go see about my rose. I want that deep red that smells like perfume. And he got the roses Friday in or Thursday in. So
right.
I'm going to buy me one.
Look at a variety called Mr. Lincoln. And you might also look at Mr. Lincoln, and there's another deep red one called Oklahoma. Those are two of the best red roses out there.
Lincoln and Oklahoma. Yeah, but do they smell pretty?
I tell you, there's one that is harder to find, but the name of it is Fragrance. At least I think that was the old name. We just call it Joe's Rose because we got our start from an old nurseryman named Joe Tocchini. But they should be in bloom now. Stick your nose in them and pick the one that smells the best. But ask if they have, I think it's an old French rose called Fragrance. That is the most fragrant red rose I've ever found.
Okay, that's what I want. And it's called, what's the name again?
Fragrance, Fragrance.
Okay. Fragrance, okay, I'll do that. Thanks a lot for your help, okay?
And you tell the good people over at Phoenix I said hello. Tell them happy anniversary. They've been in business 85 years this year. So just tell them happy anniversary. You'll get a smile out of them.
Okay, I will, Bob. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Janie. Thank you. All right, let's see if David's back there now. David, good morning.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
And I'm sitting here looking out the window getting ready to go out there and do something.
It's going to be a good day for it.
Yes, sir, it sure is. Listen, I planted some onions. I don't know. And one row of onions, one row of garlic, and the row of onions, got full of weeds.
Okay.
And I that was the time that I felt real yucky. Didn't go out there at all, man. By the time I went out there, all my garlic was gone. But my onion is beautiful. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah. Well, onions, anyway, the weeds don't really hurt anything. I mean, it doesn't make it look very pretty, but your onions will grow just fine in among the weeds, as will your garlic.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess they didn't go water it or something. I don't know. But my question is, can I plant some more garlic now, you know, around this time of, with the weather being hot?
You can. It's not going to produce as big a bulb as it would if you, planted it back in October or November.
Right.
But Howard Garrett says he plants garlic 12 months out of the year, and you'll still get a good garlic. You're just not going to get the big bulbs down at the base that you would if you planted it earlier. But nothing wrong with planting some this afternoon.
Yes, sir. Yeah. I got the space there empty, you know.
Might as well plant something and... You can plant more garlic. You can still plant onions if you'd like. Certainly a good time to plant potatoes. And beyond that, you know, all the usual suspects, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, squash, cucumbers, bush beans. They're, you're not going to have that empty space open for very long.
Listen, are my onions, they're green onions right now, are they going to turn round?
No, they usually, depending on the variety, eventually the tops will turn brown and fall over, but that's probably not going to happen until June. Your onions still have lots of good time to grow. If you want to harvest them now, they'll just be small onions, you know, a lot of people like the little so-called pearl onions. I like, you know, grilled onions, just, you know, pulling them up when they're still very small and throw them on the grill with the appropriate oil. But the longer you keep them growing and happy, the bigger the bulb will get. But they don't ripen per se. You can harvest them and use them at any size you like.
which is the one that'll turn round? You know, like this, like HEB has some, you know, round onions.
It just depends on the variety. Probably your Vidalia onions are going to be a little rounder. I've never really paid that much attention. Some of them are kind of flat. Some of them are kind of elongated. I usually judge more by the flavor than I do by the appearance. The so-called super sweet, the 1019, is probably one of the best ones as far as being a sweet onion. Now, for a, you know, a little bit stronger onion, the different Bermuda varieties are going to be good. So, yeah, I really couldn't tell you which one's going to make the roundest one.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Thank you for your help anyway. You have a nice day.
You do the same. Thank you for the call. All right. Let's see here. Let me look at my list one more time. Next up will be Carol, and then it will be Vern. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Bob. I'm scared to death.
About?
Boxwood blight. I think I have it on probably 75 boxwoods. I understand it can be spread from clippers, and I cannot find anybody that can say what might cure it. It's it will eventually just devastate the boxwoods, and also the fungus or the bacteria, whatever it is, supposedly stays in the ground, in the soil.
Well,
have you heard of this?
I've heard of it, but I think it is greatly overstated at this point, and I think that probably it can be controlled with hydrogen peroxide. Get the peroxide. I buy it in bigger bottles under what they just call non-chlorine bleach by Seventh Generation. But to my knowledge, they're thinking it's a virus. But I've got boxwoods that are over 100 years old, and I just am not seeing that as a real big problem. I guess it has occurred a few places, but it's probably in the areas where people are still using the synthetic chemical fertilizers, which make the plants more susceptible. But just continue your good gardening practices. Wipe off your pruning shears when you move from one plant to the next. If you're pruning it, you certainly don't have to do it as long as you're working on the same plant. But just wipe those shears off with peroxide or alcohol. And, I've grown a lot of boxwood. I see a lot of boxwood growing. I talked a while back to the curator of Mount Vernon, Washington's home, where they've had boxwood for, you know, a couple of hundred years or so. And we were talking about it, but with good culture, it just doesn't seem to affect healthy plants.
Well, my boxwoods were very healthy, and I noticed some browning on the tops. So I went out to clip the brown spots off, and it had moved to kill the whole stem. So that's when a friend of mine who lives in Almas Park, a landscaper, told her it's boxwood blight and it's spreading. But I'll try anything to save these.
Yeah, try the hydrogen peroxide. Get your 3% from the grocery store and dilute it 2 parts water to 1 part peroxide. Spray it every couple of weeks and get back to me and let me know. I'll do a little more research on it in the coming week. But I was asking Howard Garrett about it, and he's having the same experience up in Dallas that people are talking about it, but they're just not really seeing. Most of the problems we're seeing are on synthetically fed plants, and it's hard to say. Thinking it probably is a virus, it wouldn't hurt to put a little bit of whole ground cornmeal around the base just in case there is a fungal component to it. But I'm not ready to panic over boxwood yet. I still think it's a great shrub, and I think you'll find it is curable.
Well, I hope you're right. So that was 3% hydrogen peroxide and dilute it 2 to 1?
Yeah, 2 to 1,
okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
And keep me posted on how your boxwood does.
Yeah, I'm really I'm really nervous. I have probably 75 of them. And the ones that have been trimmed all have that same leaf death.
Well, like I say, wipe down your pruners or just dip them in some peroxide. You have to keep it covered. Hydrogen peroxide turns just to oxygen and water given just a little bit of time. So you need to store your hydrogen peroxide in a capped container. But use that to sterilize your pruners as you move from one plant to the other, and you definitely will not be spreading it when you do need to do your pruning.
All right. Well, thank you for your help.
Keep me posted. I'll look forward to hearing from you, Carol. All right. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you, Bob.
Certainly.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Jimmy, let's get our last break of the show done. We'll come back and start with Vern.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on this nice Sunday out there. It's not sunny today, and it's not supposed to be sunny today, but chances of a good rain again tonight, I think I saw 90%. We'll see whether that comes true. They usually don't get it right. But anyway, good possibility, and we definitely need some more water in the lakes and the aquifers and everything. So you keep your fingers crossed, too. Going to talk to Vern and Betty. Vern is up first. Good morning, Vern.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
I have a question. Let me stop. I'm in a tin building. Let me step outside.
Okay.
I have, at my house, I've got about 25 fish tanks, so I'm about knee-deep in fish poo. How good is that for all my plants? Is that
That's
as
great.
Good as you can get, or is that?
Yeah,
that's
it's
what I'm figuring. I put it in the garden and stuff.
Yeah, that's fish excrement is just fine. No negatives to it other than it can be a little smelly like fish themselves, but don't you know, hesitate to use it as, you know, top dressing on the soil, blend it into the soil, I think in your vegetable garden I would certainly wash your produce before you consume it, but I've always thought that, you know, if I were just starting out, I think I've once thought about creating a greenhouse production system for vegetables of various sorts, and I would put my pots up on top of benches, and underneath the benches I would put, you know, big tanks that I could raise tilapia or catfish or something like that, and then I could use the water out of that full of the fish excrement to feed the vegetables that were up on top. So I think you could create a closed system, and I think there would be a world of opportunity there if we could all live about three different lifetimes. But no, there's absolutely no negatives to that. I don't see any problem. Go ahead.
I know a lady that did exactly that. She had the tilapia and different vegetables and some plants and stuff. It was pretty nice.
Yeah.
I got about three questions. My next question, I got a lemon tree. It's in a flower pot. The tree is probably 4 or 5 feet across and 6 feet, 5 feet tall. It's about a block. It's a big plant. That thing flowered three times this year. It flowered.
Wow.
I got nothing. It flowered again. I got a few. And then if there's flowers on there now, and I got lemons that are the size of a marble or whatever.
So sounds like lemonade time. Yeah.
It's a good tree. But I've also got a lemon tree that I planted in the ground a couple years ago. It died last year, but the rootstock kept going. Is it feasible? Is it a good idea to take that, some of the branches that don't have anything on my lemon tree, and put them on there? Since I know it's a Myers lemon, I've got good lemons before, but
yeah,
I know it's Myers lemon. If I, what do you call it, splicer?
You can graft or you can bud. But, there's nothing at all wrong. You can do one or more branches on the rootstock. It's probably sour orange or carrizo. There's some different rootstocks that they use for lemons. But depending on how big the rootstock is, you could actually graft Myers lemon onto one. You could put Mexican lime onto one. You could put a Shangchao tangerine on one. You could put kumquat onto another. You can make as many grafts as you like. That rootstock is it's much more cold hardy than most of the things that are grafted onto it. Now it doesn't mean that we couldn't, you know, have another cold spell and what you grafted on could freeze. But I always tell people, be sure if you've got any of the different citrus and it's going to get so cold you're not sure if you can protect it, wrap the trunk. Because as long as you can keep the trunk protected, it'll come back as a Myers lemon or whatever else. But when you have the problem that you did and it's just coming back from the rootstock, unless you graft it or bud it, it's never going to be worth a thing.
Yeah. I mean, what is the bud it? What is that? I know I've looked into grafting. I guess I can Google bud too. But.
Well, and it's just another form of propagation, whereas with grafting, you actually take a limb, you cut that limb a certain way, you cut the spot you're going to put it on a certain way, and you fuse the two of them together. There's also something called cleft grafting, where you take a bigger trunk and, you know, graft a limb or something out toward the edge of that trunk where you've got the two cambiums matched up. Budding, you simply take a dormant bud off of what you want to put on. You typically, you know, cut a little diamond-shaped piece of bark around that bud. Then you make a slit in the bark on the rootstock and literally just kind of slip that little diamond in, and then once again wrap it up with grafting tape or cover it with grafting wax or whatever. If you are grafting something and actually grafting the wood, you're limited by how many pieces of graft wood you have. Where you're budding, you're typically, the trees will have far more buds than they have graftable limbs.
One branch has got five buds.
Yeah, the rose growers and all, they can just produce about, you know, five times or ten times as many plants through budding as they can through grafting, but both of them accomplish the same thing. You're just transferring, you know, a portion of one plant that you want to continue growing onto a stronger rootstock that's already established and growing. But it's just two different forms of propagation. I've always thought that budding was a little easier, but with grafting, you can put a little bit bigger, you know, branch on there. So both of them have their place. Both of them are interesting things. I have done it since I was in college because there's not enough hours in the day to do everything, but it's not something you can't learn very easily.
Well, you remember, I don't even remember how many years ago, Howard Garrett did that with the tangerines where he planted them seeds, mm-hmm. some straight out of tangerine and some, I got one of them trees and in 2020, I think it was probably 20 feet tall or so, 25 maybe. And in 21, it got a hit. It got hit hard. And it came back. It was coming back good last year, and then it got hit again. Is there anything I can do with that tree to promote? I've got stock in there that are probably an inch and a half across the center.
Yeah.
Bigger, around that size. I got some of them, and I've got stuff growing out of it. The tree is not dead. There's no, I mean, it's doing good.
Well, you can move to Brownsville and take it with you. Other than that, now I had a friend in San Antonio years ago, and this was when he was in high school. He literally built a greenhouse over a grapefruit tree in his backyard, and he kept building the greenhouse bigger and bigger. And I mean, this wasn't a fancy structure. This was a kind of thrown together homemade deal, but he was picking two bushels of grapefruit off that tree, you know, every winter. So, other than, like I say, building something over it that would allow you to keep it warm, I don't really know there's a whole lot you can do.
Yeah. I know there's a grapefruit tree in town here that it's on public land, so I'm not going to say where it's at, but that thing has got, that thing is huge.
Yeah.
It used to be on one of the bases.
Yeah.
But that thing is huge, and you get some good, I told my doctor I was going to grow, you know, we're just shooting the breeze. I said I was going to grow some grapefruit. He said, you got cholesterol medicine, you can't eat it. I mean, I guess not.
Yeah, that's good old bergamot thing, but it's there are some cold hardy ones around. Generally the more cold hardy ones aren't quite as sweet, so they're not quite as popular, but they're very definitely some of them that are a little bit more cold hardy. But Vern, let me let you go and get Betty in here before the end of the show. Betty, how can I help today?
Good morning. We have a number of oak trees in our yard, and they're all behaving differently this year. Well, I won't say all. Some of them seem to drop their leaves and re-leaf normally in the middle of March, as they have for the past 30 years.
Right.
The two nicest trees have not done so well. One of them dropped its leaves in December and still has not fully leafed out. As a matter of fact, I see very little green on it. The other one dropped its leaves in January and has pretty much leafed out, but they I won't look extremely healthy. Could this be due to the ice storm, the climate change, or should I suspect oat wilt?
No, I would not suspect oak wilt. Are these all live oaks?
Yes, as far as I know.
Yeah, and you know, there are many different. There's a Mexican live oak, which is a totally different tree. That, but they trees took a hit. A number of trees took a hit from the cold. Typically, the ones that were well watered came through without any problem at all. Ones in drier areas, ones that may have been stressed from being, you know, buried too deeply, did not fare quite as well. At this point, all I would do is check and be sure the root flares are exposed on the trees. It certainly would help to fertilize. Same sort of good organic fertilizer you put on your grass will benefit those trees. And let's talk again in 3 or 4 weeks. My suspicion is that the trees just have slightly different genetics, and they're going to come out just fine. But like I say, let's talk in 2 or 3 weeks, and I think you'll find things will be a whole lot better.
Okay, one thing about oak wilt. I did notice on one of the trees or under one the.
And Betty, I'm just out of time. I'm sorry. Let's talk next week more about it. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.